Good morning, everyone. My name is Bonnie McDonald. I'm the Executive Director of the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota, the statewide historic preservation advocacy and education nonprofit organization. And I'd like to welcome you to the Historic Tax Credits, What's the Big Deal About Small Deals? Just to make sure you're in the right session, because we're talking tax credits. And if you're in the wrong session, you're going to learn a lot, but you might not enjoy it as much if you were taking a field tour, or that was the intention. We who work with tax credits, though, enjoy talking about the details, because this incentive has allowed us to move forward with historic preservation in Minnesota as we never have before. For those who were at the opening session yesterday, you've seen what, as Brita said, what a game changer this has been in our field, in our industry, with working with real estate developers and contractors and other industries that contribute to the real estate field. The federal historic tax credit began in the late 1970s, and since that time has incentivized more than $1 billion in investment in historic places at the federal level, state level, and local level. The purpose of the tax credit is to catalyze development, and it is often for those projects that are the most difficult and the most challenging that would otherwise be overlooked by the development community for the lack of financial feasibility that they present. Additionally, the program incents small business owners and individuals to reinvest in more substantial maintenance of their properties, adaptive reuse of those properties, and finally, the restoration of their buildings. This 20% credit at the federal level on income taxes was enough to spur the reuse of some very monumental projects that you might be aware of. Some of the biggest would be, for example, the Fauché Tower, which was rehabilitated as a hotel in Minneapolis, or the Midtown Exchange, which was the biggest rehabilitation project we've had in Minnesota's history, on Lake Street, the former Sears Warehouse building. Even though those star projects might be familiar to you, the smaller deals of the Federal Historic Tax Credit did move forward in Minnesota as well. As one of the smaller projects that became aware to me is the Alicia's Place, which was a transitional housing development for women, for Native American women in Duluth. And that was a successful project that paired the Federal Historic Preservation Tax Credit as well as the Federal Low Income Housing Tax Credit. And you'll hear from our speakers, I'm sure, how we stack these credits and some of the complexities that come with stacking our credits. Minnesota was unfortunately falling behind the rest of our region and certainly the rest of the nation in the use of the federal historic tax credits. When you looked at the range of who had been using them in the rest of the country, we normally fell right in the middle of that stream. Despite having 7,000 listed historic properties, individual historic properties and districts in this state, we were oftentimes in the low teens or maybe below 10 federal historic tax credit projects. I know Linda is going to talk today about that increase, so I'm not going to steal her thunder, but it was a monumental increase that we have seen since we passed our state historic tax credit in 2010. And that work took more than 11 years to get that passed, and so we're very proud to have a Minnesota State Historic Tax Credit that is actually the best incentive that we're aware of in the nation, because we have an unusual incentive in that not only is it a 20% tax credit, so it's a mirror of the federal credit, but additionally, there are some interesting enhancements of it. For example, we have a grant option that is the only in the nation that has both a tax credit and a grant option for developers or property owners to take. Additionally, ours is applicable against the insurance premium tax, which who in the world knows about that? But we need to, because that means that insurance companies can invest in historic tax credits as well. And we're going to credit one of our speakers with bringing that up, and that's Norm Jones, who helped to write this legislation by bringing forth great ideas how to make our credit feasible. And finally, we have an uncapped historic tax credit, which is also a rarity in the nation. That means if you apply and you meet the criteria, you're guaranteed to get the credit or the grant. In other states, they cap the programs Some of them, like Missouri, have gone down. Iowa has capped theirs at $50 million. I think they capped the Missouri program at $150 million, which sounds like big money, but when you had a $450 million a year in tax credit applications, that was a significant drop in the amount of investment that could happen. Now, even with these two incentives combined, the federal and the state historic tax credit, it can still be very challenging for the smallest deals, and we define those as $1 million or under, to go forward. It was the goal of this legislation, though, as we were proposing it to the legislature, to have several deliverables. One of those was jobs. We were here to create jobs, and as we heard yesterday from Bob Yap, there's no better job creation mechanism than historic preservation. It creates more jobs than new construction. But furthermore, the legislators wanted to see a reinvestment in the infrastructure, in our heritage, in greater Minnesota as well. That was one of the goals, was to take this kind of activity into greater Minnesota and to see the projects that are happening in Minneapolis and St. Paul and Duluth, to see them in Main Street communities like Faribault, like Brainerd, like Red Wing as well. Linda's going to tell us more about some of those small deals that were happening, but we want to tell you about the complexities of how to use the state tax credit and federal tax credit for small deals. Why is it difficult to structure these? What are the challenges? And then examples of ways that you can capture the credit and structure projects that are under $1 million in our community statewide. So I'd like to welcome our speakers before they begin and give you a little bit of their background. Linda Pate is a preservation specialist with the State Historic Preservation Office, and familiar to many of us. She focuses on historic tax credits, Main Street, and legacy grants. Linda has a history major from the University of Minnesota, and she came to that because she is a lover of stories, like many of us. She graduated with that history degree and found that there were no jobs in history, so she moved on to the construction trades and became a carpenter for 15 years. So she has been in the trenches. She worked in historic preservation, timber framing, as well as theater and film production. Linda went back to school in 2005 to get a master's in public history with an emphasis in historic preservation. And I find it quite a coincidence that Linda's first day on the job was the day the State Historic Tax Credit was signed, which was April Fool's Day. Apropos for the amount of time it took to pass that incentive. We also have with us today Norman Jones. Norm from Winthrop and Weinstein. So Norm is an attorney and a shareholder with Winthrop and Weinstein and has been so since 1997. He has a bachelor's degree from Hillsdale College and a JD from the University of Minnesota Law School. Norm's practice areas include tax credits, affordable housing, real estate, and energy law. And he's represented developers and investors in more than 200 tax credit deals across the country. He's been voted Attorney of the Year by Minnesota Lawyer in 2006, and he was instrumental in writing the legislation for the Minnesota Historic Preservation Tax Credit. He also serves on the board of the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota, so thanks, boss, for being here, since 2010, and is a member of the Minnesota Bar Association. And finally, Donna Stevermer, in the middle, is a certified public accountant and his housing tax credit services partner and shareholder with Mahoney, Ulbrich, Christensen, and Russ. She has a degree from the College of St. Catherine in St. Paul, and her practice areas include real estate, audits, and attestation with specialties in historic rehabilitation tax credit certifications and historic tax credit and HUD cost certifications. In her tax practice area, she works in partnership tax returns, tax advice letters, and calculations of historic rehabilitation tax credits. Donna is a member of the Minnesota Society of CPAs, as well as the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, and she is also on the board of the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota. I see something familiar amongst the panelists here. Since 2006, she's been our treasurer, so I want to thank the panelists and welcome Linda to the podium first. Yes.
that I am Linda. And that first day on my new job, the Historic Preservation Office, everybody was really happy and they were sort of wandering around the halls. And I thought, they're so happy that I'm here. But I found out that they were happy because of the payoff for a long, hard work that had gone, a broad coalition of partners that had gone in to make the tax credits happen. I used to show the picture of the governor signing the legislation and everybody smiling, and I would say they were smiling because it was my first day on work, but you've probably all seen that presentation before, so I skipped it for this one. What I wanted to do is look back at some of the history and see what how the tax credit has impacted the state before. And then the other thing I have to do is figure out which one is. So this is 1979 to 2010, and over 380 projects, and quite a bit in project costs. But one of the things I found out was that 72% of all of the projects have been under $1 million. That was something that startled me, that so many times we hear, oh, we can't do projects under $1 million, can't do them. But that turns out not to be true from the past. And of the same total number of this, 42% were under 200,000. So I wanted to take another look at what kind of those projects were. Also, of the 380 projects, 17 of them were in Faribault. And of those 17, 16 were under $1 million. And so that's more proof positive that they can happen. And then comes the Minnesota State credit. In the 5 years before the passage of the credit, our office dealt with an average of 4 projects per year, some years more, some years less, but it was an average. And right now, today, 26 are in the pipeline, and we're hearing about more. Hearing about more all the time. So it has made a huge difference. And actually, of those 26, only 3 are under $1 million that we know of right now for what they're projected spending. And I'm going to run through the basics. You've probably all heard them before. For the state credit, it's different than the federal credit. You must apply before construction begins. You can do all kinds of planning and development work before, but before construction begins, you must apply to our office. The building itself must be eligible or listed on the National Register, or it must be contributing in a National Register district. It must be rehabilitated to become income producing, and it doesn't have to make a profit every year, but it does have to produce income. The project has to be substantial, and the work has to meet the Secretary of the Interior standards. I'm going to talk more about those two. What it means to be substantial is that the rehabilitation expenses must be equal to the adjusted basis of the building or $5,000, whichever is greater. So how small is small? A project could be $5,000. And in the current state of things, that with the 20% from the federal and the 20% from the state, that would get the project down to $3,000. But how does a project get that small? Is one of the main ways is if the adjusted basis is quite low. So that could be it has had the same owner for a long time and has been depreciated, or that had a very low purchase price. The Secretary of the Interior standards, the main thing that the standard number one is finding a compatible use. And I'll just read it all straight out to you. A property shall be used for its historic purpose or placed in a new use that requires minimal change to the defining characteristics of the building in its site or environment. I had the pleasure yesterday of going through the Faribault Woolen Mill, which is in the process of applying for tax credits. And in our office, we're all going, what? A woolen mill that's going to be rehabilitated to become a woolen mill? Most often we see things becoming condominiums or warehouses becoming all other things, but almost never do we see something to be rehabilitated to what it was before. So this is one of those perfect kind of projects as far as applying the Secretary of the Interior standards, because it's going to work really well that way. And again, this is the last part of the brush through. The state application process just follows along. It mirrors the federal process. The larger blue ones in the back, the part one is the evaluation of the building. It's the first thing I talked about. The part two is the description of the project itself, and that's where we're checking to see if it meets the Secretary of the Interior standards. And the part three is after it's all the work is completed, and we're checking to make sure that you did what you said you were going to do. So then I wanted to look back at specific projects just within the last 10 years, but it turns out that there haven't been any small under a million projects since 06. But of those projects, the very most typical one that fits right here in Faribault and in many parts of Minnesota, the very most typical one is in a downtown commercial district, or very near downtown commercial district in greater Minnesota. There were 16 of those, and the second most typical one is something like either a residence or a barn that's turned into a bed and breakfast, and there were four of those. So that's the type of project that we're seeing that is a small project. It's usually owned by a single owner and rehabilitated by that owner. Some of the examples of the downtown commercial districts are commercial rehabs. There were two libraries that turned into law offices, and there was one courthouse that turned into a commercial building. The courthouse was in Rosso, and the libraries were in Dawson and Greenwood. And that's it for my part. I wanted to leave most of it to the details. The other thing I always say in my presentations is don't take tax advice from SHPO. So I'm going to step away from the podium right now. Thank you all.
I'm sure these are on. Can everybody hear me?
Can you hear me? Well, we're going to talk a little bit how to do small deals. A lot of deals, if they're over $10 million in qualified rehab expenditures, there's a lot of people out there that want the credits or buy the credits. But if you have a small deal, it's important to know who can use the credits so that you can figure out how to structure your projects. I'm going to talk a little bit about the federal and the state historic credits, because users who can use them will be different depending on the type of credit. So to start with the federal historic credit, who can use the credit? Corporations can use the credits. Individuals can use the credits. And if you're a corporation, it's pretty easy to use it against your federal tax. If you're an individual, it's a little more difficult because there's a few more rules for individuals in using the historic credit. First of all, the historic credit can reduce your regular tax, but it does not reduce your self-employment tax. So if you have self-employment tax, you're not able to use the historic credit. Beginning in 2007, they're allowing you to use the historic credit against the AMT tax. So that's a big bonus for people to be able to use it. One thing that you have to worry about, though, is the historic credit is derived from rental real estate activities, and that's deemed a passive activity by the IRS. So it's a passive credit, and it can only be used to offset taxes against passive income, plus up to $25,000 of income without being an active participant. So there are exceptions to that. If you're a real estate professional, you're considered to be active participation and you don't have the passive limits. And then there's, if you incur over 750 hours of services in that, that's how you become active, and there's a few other rules for that. So the HTC is claimed against your federal tax. If it exceeds your tax liability for the year, the excess credit can be carried back 1 year or forward 20 years. And beginning in 2010, there were some special rules for small businesses that may be able, if if you qualify, you may be able to carry the credit back 5 years. You also have to worry about some at-risk rules. So if you're an individual, you really want to check with your tax practitioner to see how much of the credits you can use for the federal credit. The state credit is a little more easy to use. The state credit can be used by corporations, individuals, and also nonprofits are able to use the state credits. Our state credit has a couple different options, as Bonnie and Linda both mentioned. We have the grant option, so the nonprofit could take the grant. An individual could take the grant, and they'd have to pick up the taxable income, though. And corporations could take the grant and pick up the income, too. But also, Minnesota is a refundable credit, which means that you could apply for a refund and get 100% of the credit back as a refund. So that might be a better option than the grant, because the grant is 90 cents. You apply for a refund, it's 100% of the credit. The refund is probably taxable to you if you're an individual or a corporation, depending on your situation. So Norm's going to talk a little bit about if you're not able to use it as an individual or your local bank can't use it, how do you structure a project if you're going to go out for the summer.
Thanks, Donna. Well, you usually only come to the blood-sucking lawyer if you can't get it solved yourself. No, that's not true. So you're a developer or you're a sponsor and you own a historic building. You might have. We're going to go through some numbers a little bit later, and we may not have brought enough handouts, but some lucky few will have a piece of paper with a picture on it and some boxes on it. So you've got two tax credit assets. Think of them as things to sell, things to convey away for money. You've got your federal historic credit and your state historic credit. So when you're sitting there and you say, I need to get rid of these and get money for them, the things we get asked most often are, Norm, how do we get the most out of it? Norm, how do we keep it simple? And, by the way, if there's any tax risks, how do we keep those, to a minimum? And I say you can get about 2 out of 3 of those. And by the way, I'm expensive. No, I'm just kidding. Most of our structures are then, really, they revolve around combining our sale of the federal credits, if you will, and I use sale loosely, and our sale of the state credits. And it's all going to happen together. Because the entities or buyers taking the state credits, the federal credits, are not usually the same as the ones taking the state. So the state and the federal credits are going different directions, and our job is to combine those streams of money into one structure that works well. Okay? And the state investor and the federal investor want different things. So let's talk a little bit about what the investor market is out there. People have told you that there's lots of different options for the state credit. I mean, it's a perfectly beautiful apple, right, that anybody wants to buy. Okay, I'm sorry, I will. All right. Is this better? No? Is this better? All right, I'll talk right into it. So, to repeat, other people have said there's many options to how to get rid of your state credits, how to sell them for cash. You've got the refund, you've got the grant option, and then you could also just convey the credit to an investor. So that's a lot of options to have. You're not going to have any problem getting rid of your state credits and getting some good value for them. That's not going to be a problem. Now let's talk about the federal credits. We have very few options on the federal credits. It's a credit. That means you have to find some investor that's paying federal tax that wants to use this credit. And that's our bottleneck right there. For very large deals, there's an active federal investor market. And we would have no problem finding, you know, an investor to take a large chunk of credits. But our bottleneck comes because we have we want to go ever smaller chunks of credits, and still have the investor go through all the time and legal work and due diligence necessary. And so below a certain threshold, investors start dropping out of that market. They start saying you can't do it below a certain threshold. So for some large major national banks, that threshold's about $3 million in credits. Below that threshold, there's another tier of investors who are still in, who are still willing to go through it. And that next tier is between about $500,000 in credits and $3 million. And you'll still get good value for your federal credits, but not quite as much. It's not going to be some bidding war and the price is being bid up and you feel lucky. Still a good market. Predictable. I can tell you what you're going to get for them, and you can write that in your pro forma, and you can count on it. And that's key, right? As a developer or a sponsor, the credits are what they are. You just want to be able to predict what to do with them. You want to be able to write it on a piece of paper. I'm going to get this amount so I can balance my sources and uses. I need to fill the rest with fundraising or debt. But you want to be able to predict what you can get, and you want to be able to predict what you can get early, not at the 11th hour when you're desperately trying to sell something. You want to be able to model that pretty correctly very early on in the process, so you can tell all your stakeholders what the real target is for your fundraising. So that middle tier market is between, let's say, 500,000 credits and 3 million credits. But how do we do below 500,000 credits? Well, as it turns out, there is a small but functioning market for credits between about 250,000 and 500,000. And I've, on this piece of paper that some of you have, I've put those example economic terms or financial terms from that typical investor in that level, and we can kind of go through some numbers in just a minute. So there is a functioning market, predictable. If you have at least, let's say, 250,000, maybe a little bit less, maybe our 200,000 number, we can with certainty tell you that we've got a deal, and then you can build that in, and it's going to take you, months to get the rest of the project pulled together, but you can count on it. Now, these economics aren't terribly exciting. They're not all that great for that level of that level of credits. So what do we do if we have, let's say, below 200,000 in credits? There really is no functioning market. What that means is now we're talking to local friends and family. We're talking to talking to real estate professionals that might be involved in the deal. We're talking to the bank that might be lending on the deal, because the bank might be able to take the credits and might be able to give you something for it. Or maybe we're talking about you as the sponsor or owner keeping them yourself and using them, getting some value out of that. But below about 200,000, it's kind of do it yourself finding an investor. And we start with, it's going to take more time up front. And until you find that investor, I can't tell you that you can count on the money. So that means we start earlier and get somebody lined up. So that's the market. Just in terms of general prices, federal investors are paying about right around a dollar per credit of equity for, let's say, $1 million to $2 million chunk of credits. from 500,000 to about a million or two, the price might be more in the 90 cent range. And then below 250,000 credits, we're probably talking in the 60 range, 60 cent range by the time you take out some of the fees and costs and expenses and returns. So, let's move to, I want to go through a diagram that I think some of you have. On this, looks like this, and if you don't have one, raise your hand. Okay, that's a lot. All I have is paper copy. I'm sorry, but I will give you one after. I will be able to email this to you after. It's not that hard. I think we can try to describe what's going on. My apologies for not bringing up copies. Every deal has an owner. So let's talk about the structure of how the federal investor and the state investor come together. You're going to have this project owned by an LLC, some separate entity you've set up to own the title to this real estate. Why do you do that? Well, talk to your own lawyer, but to establish some liability shield. We're assuming that you're going to set up a special LLC to hold the title to this real estate. Into this LLC, we're going to admit as a partner the federal investor. You're going to own 99% stated membership interest in this LLC. You as the sponsor or developer are going to be the other partner in this LLC that owns the property. So let's look at what the small deal fund. There is actually a fund called the Small Deal Fund out there. I can give you the details on that. But let's look at what they would give you if you gave them 250,000 credits. Now, 250,000 credits means you're going to have 1.25 million in qualified rehab expenditures, right? Times 20%, that's how you get your 250,000 credits. The small deal fund can give you a gross amount of about $200,000 in equity for those credits. If you're keeping track, that's about 83 cents. From that gross price, they extract some dollars, they extract some legal fees. They extract an annual cash return that the project must pay them. They extract a small annual asset management fee that the project must pay them for looking over your shoulder. Not that you really need that. Why do we need them to look over our shoulder anyway? And then at the end of the project, when all the credits are done and used and they can safely exit, And for those of you that know this, it's 5 years. So at the end of 5 years, the investor can safely exit without jeopardizing their tax credits. But at the end of 5 years, this particular fund needs about 15% of their equity back as an exit cost, an exit fee. So if we subtract all that out, we're about in the 60 cent range, give or take, net cash divided by the amount of the credits that we gave them. So, there, you know, would you say that's efficient? It's not as efficient as a larger deal. Would you say that's better than not having anybody buy your federal credits at all? Yes. Is it predictable? Yes. So, when you're doing your modeling and you want to plug in these facts and figures, you can count on them. So that's the federal side. I don't want to go the whole time and then not have any questions, but just from time to time, I'm just going to say if we have any questions so far. So this is one of those times, any questions so far. the major investors are large banks. U.S. Bank, Wells, Bank of America, you know, whatever bank is not in dire, whatever national bank is not in dire trouble and has no tax credit appetite that day. I'll pick on another one that we've dealt with for decades. Chevron has been an investor in historic tax credits for a long, long time. They're one of those that have, I think, been, you know, they don't necessarily pay top dollar, but they're predictable. And if we had a large amount of credits, you can go right to Chevron. You can either call them up or call a broker, and he calls up Chevron directly. Chevron will directly invest in your deal. But they also have created these middle-tier funds where they delegate some of the due diligence to a fund manager who wants to do this. And so Chevron can kind of pull back a little bit and say, okay, you fund manager, go set up the deal between $500,000 and $3 million. You can use our money, but you kind of do the deal and you take some of the risk. And so that's a great way for Chevron to do some middle market deals. But actually the small deal fund that I'm giving you an example here for is actually Chevron too. So I pick on them because they're in every strata. They found a way to do big, middle, and small. And for that, I like them. And I don't know if they're top dollar. Did that answer your question? Okay. Any other questions on the federal side? Let's talk about the state then, because it's a little more complicated. If our owner entity that got this piece of paper that said they have a state credit, they could go back to SHPA and say, give me my grant of 90 cents. And SHPA would give them a check. That check of 90 cents coming in is taxable income. So I kind of want to worry more about the taxable income side. It's what keeps me up at night, more so than just converting it to cash. Because the converting the credit to cash, we know how to do. It's easy to do. But it's the taxable effect of that that keeps us up at night. So if you go get your check for 90 cents on a dollar from SHPA, that's 90 cents of tax. Taxable income. So who's going to pay it? Do you have enough money to pay it as, from the project? Well, that's just extra fundraising. It kind of really eats into the value of your state credit if you do it like that. Maybe you have, maybe the sponsor, you've got losses from some other deal. You've got depreciation from some other deal you own down the road. So you don't mind. Hey, that's no problem. I'll just take that income because I've got other losses that I can use. That makes it worth it. That's been done before too. Maybe you think that the federal investor is going to take all that income. I assure you they're not. And moreover, they're going to try to protect themselves against even the possibility that they get that income by making sure the allocation of that income is written in the agreement, goes right to you. So, we're back to you again. What are you going to do with that income? The rest of this conversation is going to deal with structures that try to minimize that or delay that, try to mitigate that. Before we get to that, by the way, if you take a grant, it's income. What if you take the refund? What if you the owner waits till April 15, files a state tax return, claims your state credits on your state tax return, and there's more credits than you pay tax, well, the excess, you get a check back from now the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Tax refund. Is that income? Most people would say yes, that's income too. So you haven't, I know you were thinking that, but you haven't avoided the income problem. And then what if, third result, what if we take the piece of paper and we just sell it to an investor? There's some very active investors in Minnesota, but all they want that is that piece of paper to put in the credit. What if we just sell it, the piece of paper, to them? Let them take it back. Taxable income too. Sorry. So we're trapped. Or are we? Well, so you try to make this exciting. Well, let's turn to our second page. Those lucky few, and I apologize again to those that don't have a page. Many professionals try a lot, and have thought about and keep thinking about ways to mitigate this taxable income problem. And there are any number of structures that have been proposed and done. And they all have different tax risks associated with them. Meaning, let's say we take a tax position. What if we get challenged by the IRS? What's our risk that this will be overturned? And despite our best efforts, it's taxable income anyway. So that's what I mean by tax risk, is you take a position that you think is valid, but it gets overturned, and then what if? And then what happens then? And you do have to think about the what ifs, and plan for them. One structure that we see gaining traction is, I call it the lost partner structure. But in the lost partner structure, we have a partner that comes into our owner, and they have, from some other unrelated activity, tons of NOLs, tons of net operating losses from something else. Maybe they're in bank stock or something. So they have tons of NOLs that they can't use, or they can't use yet. And they're willing to take a big slug of income from you because they can shelter it with their net operating losses. They're willing to do that at a price. And the price is not too bad when you think of it. But there is one very active lost partner entity, and I'll give you the name later, but that their price to do that is between 5 and 7% times the credit amount. So if we are talking about 250,000 credits, we're talking roughly $15,000 to $18,000 is the price for doing that. So it might still be taxable income to the owner, but then we're able to allocate in partnership world, we're able to allocate income to partners generally how we want. So we allocate all the income to that partner, and they take it. Sounds too good to be true, doesn't it? It's actually not. It's not too good to be true. There's some costs down the road, but for the time being, this is a pretty good structure. Then the lost partner does whatever they want to do with the credit. They could either, again, kind of all three are the same. More or less the same result. The lost partner can either file for a refund, file for a grant, sell it to a third party. So at that point, you just want to do whatever can give you the most amount of proceeds from the lost partner sells. Lost partner then takes that money minus their spread, their $15,000 to $18,000, give or take, spread, and puts the balance in as a capital contribution in your project. And your owner. The capital contributions aren't taxable. So that's a good way to to not avoid the taxable income, but to get it to somebody else for the time being. So that's the loss partner structure. And the end result is we probably have brought in more state credit net equity out of that structure than some other structures. I don't know if I'll wade too far into the weeds talking about a lot of other structures. There are others possible. They have varying amounts of tax risk, and you should talk to your tax advisor. Need to add more? I think I'm going to turn this back over to Donna for the next stage.
Good job, Don. So I'm going to talk a little bit about if you are going to go to these investors, well, what do you need? What are they going to want from you? What do you have to show them? It's always important to know. So if you're going to go to an investor, you want to be prepared. If you're not prepared, it's going to take a lot longer to get to closing. You always want to get to closing as soon as you can. You're going to want to make sure you've applied for the National Park Service Part 1 and probably had your Part 2 done with the type of rehab work you're going to do. If you have both of those done, that's a good thing to have to go to the investor. You're going to want finance commitments. You're going to need to have a construction loan, bridge loan, your permanent financing commitments. You're going to want those because the investor is going to need to know how you're going to fund this project. One thing you're going to want with the financing commitments that you need to think about really for the state historic credits and the federal historic credits is the timing. The federal investors aren't going to put all their money in up front. They'll usually put a nominal amount in up front, and then most of it will come at placed in service, or sometimes they will come back to Part 3. State credits, depending on if you have the investor, they're probably going to want your certificate if you're going with a loss partner, or that before they're going to put their money in. If you're personally taking it, it's going to be when you file your tax return. So let's say if you get 2011 credits, you get your certificate in 2011 from the state or from CHIPO. Then it's going to go on your 2011 return, which you're not going to file until 2012. And if you're an individual that has a lot of the investments and other partnerships or something, you might not get your return filed until October of 2012, or September, I mean. So September of 2012, or individual October. So you're going to, you need a bridge loan to cover that. So you need to figure out your structure to know how long this bridge loan is going to be. If you get the grant option, you're going to need time to find out how long it takes CHIPO to issue the grant from the time you submit your Part 3. You're going to need your National Park Service Part 3 to even get the Minnesota credit. The federal credit you can take before you have the Part 3, but the Minnesota credit you don't get until you have the Part 3. So your financing commitments are very important, and knowing how you're structuring the deal is important so that you don't have a bridge loan that's 12 months and it comes due and you have no equity coming in. That would be a problem. You're going to want a complete development budget where the sources and uses balance. So you're going to want to have a good estimate of what you're going to receive for the credits, both federal and state from a pricing standpoint. You're going to need an estimate of your qualified rehab expenditures. And you need a good estimate because the investor, they're going to have credit adjusters. They're only going to pay you for what they get. So if you think you're going to deliver, you know, $250,000 of credits, in the end it really only comes in at $200,000, well, they're going to reduce the amount they put in for capital, so you're going to have to come up with the difference, which means you're going to have gap funding or put the money in yourself. And for your qualified rehab expenditures, it's important to know what costs are good costs and bad costs. Personal property doesn't count, land improvement doesn't count, enlargement to the building doesn't count, acquisition costs don't count. It's really just the hard construction that's depreciable property of the building. And you have to worry about the building can't be tax-exempt use property, which I think we'll talk about a little bit later. You're going to need a detailed operating projection. You're going to want to show that the project can cash flow. The investor is probably going to take a priority return, as Norm said, and an asset management fee each year. you're going to want to be able to take some money. So, and your loans are going to require at least a 1.15 debt service coverage. Some loans may require 1.2. We're starting to see more of lately. So you're going to want to have a good set of financials so to go forward. So does anyone have any questions so far? Then I'll turn it back to Norm and I'll kind of, yeah.
Shout it out. Go ahead. I don't see the hand, but is there a question?
Oh.
Go ahead.
Oh, it can't be tax-exempt use property, which I think we might talk a little bit next about how nonprofits, if nonprofits are involved, what some of the complications can be. So if a nonprofit wholly owns a building, it's considered tax-exempt use property. So it's not, it's depreciated over 40 years, not 27 years. And you're not allowed the federal credit for that.
So if you have a nonprofit involved, it means just extra work to structure it. Not that the nonprofit can't own a partnership interest, and other stakes in the building, but it means extra structuring so that we're not running afoul of the nonprofit use or tax-exempt use rules in the code. The penalty for that is no federal credits. So it's possible, many nonprofits have different stakes in deals and still are able to sell the federal credits. This means more structure.
And it's good to have nonprofits in the deals if you can, because they have access to a whole bunch of grants that they can take in as income on the nonprofit side and make capital contributions or loans to the project. It just takes a lot more structuring. There's a lot more structuring issues that you have to consider to make sure you don't jeopardize the federal credits. Yep, they would be the same. Any tax exempt entity.
Doing federal historic tax credits on for sale condos is a challenge. It's a challenge. That's almost a special topic. It's been tried different ways, but the essential challenge is somebody's got to own the property for investment for 5 years. Well, that, how do you do that, but at the same time, you're trying to sell it right away? That's the challenge. Maybe we talk about that after this. I'm not sure there's a great solution to that. Except for the if it's a commercial condo, then the credits can go to the condo buyer, commercial condo buyer. I've seen people try to do something that looks like a lease for 5 years, and then it's a sale. So I've seen that too. You say energy credit? Okay. They're twins. I mean, they're almost clones of each other. They work the same. They can be structured the same. They're claimed the same, with such minor differences that it's almost not even worth going into. So we do see those combined a lot, and the same. If you have a federal historic investor who wants to buy those, 99 times out of 100, they'll take the energy credit too. It works the same for them. Oh, there's one. They're not twins.
No, but they are combined a lot. The low-income housing tax credits and the historic credits are combined a lot. A lot of times it's bigger deals. Rarely see a $1 million deal that's both low income and historic. And in the bigger deals, what a lot of people will do is it's called a sandwich lease structure, because the historic credit reduces your basis. So if you're combining it with low-income housing credit, your historic credit's going to reduce your eligible basis, unless you do this sandwich leaf structure in which you pass the historic credit through to the master tenant entity, and then you don't have to reduce the eligible basis or depreciable basis with the historic credit, so you get more low-income that way.
I'll say one thing. Most often, if you have succeeded in getting a low-income housing credit investor, most often they'll take from you the historic too. They might not give you top dollar, but it's close enough. Versus just the total brain damage of trying to separate them out and convince both parties that it works. And, it's a lot simpler to sell them both to the low-income housing investor. Yes. Churches, it's been a while since I've, looked at this, but churches are treated as tax exempt, I think, for all purposes, whether they've got a ruling or not. So, you're back in the same category of tax exempt used property, which means that it's going to require some structuring to do that. Not only ownership can give you tax exempt used property, but use. Maybe text of use property. So if you were thinking about, hey, let's just lease it back to a nonprofit, there's some rules we can do that within parameters. So ownership or use, or even being a partner in the owner, and all three of them can give you text of use. Just you need a professional to kind of help walk you through that. On tax exempt. I think I'm going to turn it back to Bonnie here in about 1 minute. This wouldn't be complete without at least a statement about somebody saying the Virginia case, which is something that didn't exist last year at this time, or at least not in this form. And so the Virginia case is a federal circuit court decision that in which the federal circuit court sided with the IRS against the taxpayer. And in general, the IRS is taking the position, a winning position, I think, that if we have our owner entity and we have a partner in the owner, and the owner allocated some credits, state credits, to that partner. Within 2 years of the partner putting money into the partnership, that's a disguised sale of the credits. Sale being a bad, well, I'm using bad quotes now. And so the service's position is the credits in that case are property. They're property. And when you sell property, it's a taxable transaction. And your gain on that transaction is equal to what you got for them minus what you paid for them. So if I'm partnership sitting here and the service says, my Minnesota credits are property, and I transferred them to a partner within 2 years of the partner paying me money, no matter what I called the money, capital contribution, loan, whatever, no matter what I called it, service is stating a position that's a taxable sale or a disguised sale. And then your taxable income light goes off. So that's how the IRS, that's why the IRS did it, so they could get some taxable income, and they've been winning with that argument because they have regulations drafted a while ago that seemed to just be very close to what we normally do. So in the last year, you've seen tax advisors almost knuckle under. I mean, I'd still like to fight the IRS on this, but it's a tough one. And in our practice, we're advising people to view that as a real risk and to act accordingly and structure to avoid it. Lost partner is our answer to that Virginia case. Anything else on the Virginia case?
I think part of what it did is it made it harder to use nonprofits with the state historic credits. A lot of original structures were to give the certificate to the, or have the nonprofit get the grant, but to give the certificate to the nonprofit, have the nonprofit sell it, and then put the money back in as a capital contribution. And if you have this disguised sale income risk, the income can't be allocated back to the nonprofit because of tax avoidance rules and other rules. So that means the income is in the partnership and it either has to go to the general partner or investor, and the investor doesn't want it. So it's just made it really difficult to use the nonprofits how people had intended to use, I think. And it's making, it's a lot of the federal historic investors are the ones that are going to drive. It's how their council is going to interpret stuff on what's going to drive how the estate investing might be done. But yeah, I think it's caused a lot of uproar in the industry, and it'll be interesting to see how it turns out. It's caused a lot of questions in structuring.
Any quick questions before we turn it back to Bonnie? I got the last piece of this. So, I think what you're describing is a nonprofit is a partner. The credit is allocated up to that nonprofit, hasn't it?
Grant's designated to the nonprofit.
The grant is designated, okay.
Well, I mean,
you should take this.
There's controversy on the grant issue a little bit, too. There's risk. The question is the grant originally the partnership's grant, or is it a grant similar to other grants nonprofits get and they can do it? So there could be risk to the partnership with the nonprofit getting the grant, because it could be considered an assignment of income from the partnership to the nonprofit to get the grant. Or if it's, you know, the state says designated, so some people have the mindset that if it's designated and the grant documents are written directly to the nonprofit, that it's not income to the partnership. So that is an option out there as a structure, I would say. And, you know, sometimes the general partner of the partnership is a nonprofit, and they might be the one getting the grant, too, directly. So there is this.
There might be a legislative fix. In Iowa, just I think by accident, Iowa has a statute that allows the nonprofit to consider that it originally was the possessor of the credit. No transfers. Nothing to transfer, nothing for the IRS to get their teeth into about, hey, that was a disguised sale. But I think that was an accident in the Iowa statute, and in some cases it's worked out pretty nice where the might be a nonprofit sponsor. They applied for the credit to begin with, and then only later did they transfer the real estate into, you know, one of these federal historic investor structures. But they kept the credit. The credit was never transferred. That might be our answer to the Virginia case in Minnesota. I'd make that little tweak, and that might be the response. But.
And I do know there is some legislation out there for the federal credits that are trying to get rid of any proceeds from state sale credits is non-taxable. They're trying to get that passed out there too, but
yes, and I wanted to return to the podium to talk about the legislative aspect of the state credit as well as the federal credit. So to comment on what Donna was just saying, do you have a question, Erin? Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
And we are in the development phase. Actually, our intern Neela over here has developed a real estate network for us, and so we've developed a list of real estate professionals, attorneys, accountants, appraisers, contractors, developers, tax credit investors, who are working in Minnesota, and we can serve in that capacity. Yes. Yeah. And as part of our program to develop a real estate component to what we do, we've looked at different structures for how we could become helpful investors to programs. Some of the structures that we've discussed today, we're looking at purchase options, we're looking at revolving loan funds like Historic St. Paul has for the rest of the state. We have an easements program, which is a real estate tool. And we also are considering other educational options. We did a realtor training last year to train realtors how to market historic properties, because they're often the first line of defense that we have on how to promote a historic property. But we intend to continue that work in actual tangible property work. So if I may to speak to what Donna was saying, that as historic preservationists, we need to be aware of what is happening legislatively, because it truly, as you can see with the state historic tax credit, going from 4 projects to 26 in the period of a year is impactful in truly preserving these properties. We have a number of endangered properties in the state, and we really need to address them with a real estate approach oftentimes to get to some successful reuse. At the federal level, we do need to be involved as citizen advocates. And the legislation that Donna mentioned is part of, it's sort of a grab bag of historic preservation. There have been efforts for many years to fix some of the problems especially with the layering of the low-income housing tax credit and the federal historic tax credit. So there's a bill that has combined that effort to improve the historic tax credit with what we've learned about allocations, and then also to put in components about the funding for our historic preservation fund as well. I would encourage you to be members, of course, of the Preservation Alliance, because we are a voice for you on Capitol Hill as well. We go to lobby day, try to go to lobby day every year at the federal level and talk with our legislators. And in fact, one of our legislators, Representative Congresswoman Betty McCollum, is part of the Historic Preservation Caucus. And so we do have a voice for preservation at Capitol Hill. So please either support the Alliance or go right to the federal level, and you can support Preservation Action, which is the 501c4 lobbying organization for historic preservation, or of course be members of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, who works up on Capitol Hill. So watch that piece of legislation, and then at the state level, I'll be knocking on Norm's door to come and draft some improvements. Now that we know how the credit actually works, we've seen it for the past year, now we know what we have to tweak in that. And so the Preservation Alliance will go back to the state capitol with the Minnesota Historical Society representing SHPO, and we will approach the legislature on what fixes we need to make. In doing that, though, we do bring up the issue of the tax credit, and in a time of budget reductions, we do always run the risk, potentially, of having lots of questions asked about the loss of income to the state, even though it returns more than it takes out in state taxpayer funds. So I wanted to tell you that We will continue to return to the state capitol, David Kelleher down here, and myself and many others, to talk about the success of the credit to try to fix that. But we need all of you to be a voice for us, because it is really you talking to your legislators about the value of this program, as well as the return on investment that the economic impact statement from SHPO states. So $9 to every $1 is an incredible return on investment, and we'll be able to show that 3,000 jobs that have been created, which is incredible.
So at this time, we have about 17 minutes for questions, and thankfully, I do want to thank the speakers because we have an incredible wealth of knowledge here today. So if you have complex questions or simple questions about tax credit structure, now's the time to ask because these people are the experts who do this. So are there some additional questions out there?
First thing is, when we leave, I'm first out because I want that last donut out.
Dibs on the last donut. Ben.
Well, let's say the building right now is owned by a nonprofit entity. In order to get the federal credit to, in order to get some value out of the federal credit, we need a federal investor. And that means we're going to have a federal investor in as a partner. And so that means that you're going to transfer that real estate into a newly formed LLC that's going to have at least two partners. One can be the nonprofit, let's call it as a 1%, stated partner, and the other partner is the federal investor with the 99%. That doesn't necessarily describe how all the cash flow of the property goes, but that's how the tax income and tax loss goes, 199. And that's okay. That's a pretty simple way to do it, too. That doesn't describe how to deal with the state credit, though. So on top of that, you would layer one of these ideas to deal with the state credit. Or possibly one of those ideas involves that same nonprofit dealing with the state credit. But in any case, you're going to get the real estate out of ownership by the nonprofit and into really a for-profit LLC entity. That could cause you probably some real estate tax issues. There's some further structures. If real estate tax is really important, there's some further structures that are more complicated than this, that preserve the tax exemption, the real estate tax exemption while doing this. I don't know if that's tantalizing enough or not, but we have to really get into the weeds to describe that. I'd be happy to. I'm sure Don would be happy.
There.
Yeah, the federal investor is not going to want. They don't want to take real estate risk. They want to view this as a financial transaction, kind of a, you give me the credits, I give you the equity. So they're going to want the 1% to guarantee that the thing will be complete, so a construction completion guarantee. And also then an operating deficit guarantee to keep it running for at least 5 years. And then finally, a tax credit recapture guarantee. If it gets foreclosed on the first 5 years, and that means that the investor loses their equity and their tax credits, they're going to want to come back to somebody to get made whole. So those are kind of three main guarantees that 1% would normally give. Yeah, in year six, there's usually a purchase option or a sale option arrangement that allows the 1% partner to buy out the 99% partner at one or the other's election. So if the 99% partner elects to get bought out, the price is usually fixed up front. It's determinable. You know exactly what that number is. If for some reason they don't demand to get bought out, but you want them out anyway. You have a call option. You have an option to buy them out, but it's, you can't fix that number in advance. You can try to massage it to get the number into a small limit, small range, but you can't determine the number in advance. On the first option, yeah, on the investor's put option, we call it, the range is from 5% of their upfront investment up to, I've seen 15% of their original investment. So we kind of just have to plan for that at the beginning, that we're going to have a cost to get them out at the end.
I just wanted to give two examples, and I don't have the list in front of me of who's used the state credits, but two developers. One would be Aon, which is an affordable housing developer, and they just completed the first state historic tax credit project, and that was the Renaissance box that Brita mentioned yesterday, the historic O'Donnell Shoe Factory in St. Paul. So that's one structural option to look at if need be then. The second that has applied for the credits was one from ArtSpace, which is also uses affordable housing credits to create artist live workspace, and they've been doing this for many years with the federal credit, and they are they've applied for a small project to do some maintenance work on a project they use historic tax credits on in the early 90s, and so. That's a small deal. That's that one's under $100,000. I think it's just $100,000 to $200,000. And so that's another structure that would also be a small deal for a nonprofit. Yes. $11,000. What was the last part? Sure. Yes, the legislation was introduced in 2000 after we worked for a few years on actually writing the legislation, trying to find a sponsor at the legislature. And ours was based on the 1997 passage of the Missouri State Historic Tax Credit. So our effort began in 2000. I think Senator Sandy Pappas may have been one of the first bill authors out of St. Paul, and over the first several years were really educating the legislators about the value of the state historic tax credit and why it was needed, and because at the time there weren't as many states that had this, in the intervening 11 years we saw many states adding this over time, and thankfully that gave us ammunition to show how we were falling behind, how the return on investment was going to be substantial based on those other states. So in a way that helped us to demonstrate our case. I would say that in the middle years, the difficulty was really at the tax committee level. So at times we had a tax committee chair in the House that was not favorable to any tax credit as a tax policy issue. Oftentimes that was our issue, was really the leadership of the tax committees themselves were opposed to or did not see the value in the historic tax credits as a matter of tax policy. We started to gain some traction after, I believe, 2007, 2008, when we hired a lobbying firm, McGrann Shea, to help us at the Capitol. They had relationships that we didn't necessarily have, or they could present a new view on it that we couldn't have as nonprofits. And spoke a lot for the business community and had credibility with the business community. And that did help us, again, to educate the legislators to get further on in the process. And eventually we were included in the omnibus tax bill, and we suffered from being in one bill and not in the other, because there needs to be House and a Senate versions of those bills to then come to conference committee. So, we'd be in one and not the other. We'd come to conference committee and we wouldn't be included in the final bill based on budgetary concerns. So what made the final difference was actually our partnership with what's called the Building Jobs Coalition. This is just indicative of how important partnerships really are in anything that we do. We were asked to join the Building Jobs Coalition, which is a group of the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota, so the contracting community, the trades unions, as well as local government, and cities, city agencies. So it was a collaborative effort of private, nonprofit, unions, who all saw, and the Architects AIA Minnesota, who saw that we had no industry after 2008 as the market tanked. So we were able to include the state tax credit as a job creation tool in their jobs bill legislation. And we saw a buy-in on that end when we demonstrated the jobs that would be created. So I would say that it was the right place at the right time with the right message. We were able to demonstrate how many jobs were created in the other communities, the return on investment. We had favorable legislators who were being pressured to create jobs, especially in the construction industry, that was not being highlighted. The other jobs initiatives were very white-collar, tech-oriented jobs. So that, thankfully, we had the right partners in place that we had built relationships with. We had advocates there at many levels working with us at the Capitol, and we were able to demonstrate that we could meet the budget thanks to some creative ways to meet the budget concerns, and we were able to get it passed, and it was bipartisan. It was a bipartisan bill. Mila, did you have a question? No? Okay. I saw your hand up. We could take a couple more questions. I have to point to Eli because we used the Maryland credit as one of our examples as well from Baltimore Heritage. Maryland was one of the very successful states that had demonstrated a very high return on investment that we were able to show.